I'm your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, lordsofpain.net. Wherever you may be listening, Doc says.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast, Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania Era, the Book of Sports Entertainment, and of the Doctor's Orders on lordsofpain.net. Hello and welcome to The Doc Says on the Chairshot Radio Network. I am your host, The Doc Chad Matthews, author of The Greatest Matches and Rivalries of the WrestleMania Era, which I'm proud to announce will be hitting the airwaves in audiobook form next month. And from wherever you're listening, thank you for making me a part of your day. It's time for another Doc Says edition of the Sunday Wrestling Conversation, during which a guest joins me for about an hour-long wrestling chat. My first guest for this segment was Rich Latta, writer of the Doc Says theme song, still in need of a chair shot remixing, wink, wink, host of One Nation Radio on the Social Suplex Podcast Network, and one of the best friends of the program. Folks, Rich has come back for more. Welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, glad to be here, Doc, as always. It's always awesome to talk wrestling with you.
Likewise. Well, it's been about 4.5 months since you've been on. You were the first guest. It was March 1st of this year.
My God, this year is flying by.
It is. I was thinking that earlier today, prepping for the show in my mind. I haven't talked to you. I think we've talked, but it's been on different programs. We haven't had the chance to just kind of sit down and have a one-on-one chat. Yeah. So, today, ladies and gentlemen, with Rich and I both still connecting to the recent NBA offseason, which, for those of you who don't follow, was about as wild and crazy as any sports offseason has ever been in terms of player movement, player empowerment manifested, the manner in which the moves affected the title race for next season. And we're obviously both very much connecting to the G1 climax right now. So what we thought we'd do today is combine passions for both. We were talking last week about what to discuss today, and I'd mentioned to him that once I started thinking of Tomohiro Ishii, a strong style savant who I had initially disliked because of how strong style often demands these bursts that I'm not real fond of in the beginning when I first started watching it, of this sort of blatant no-selling. Once I connected him as New Japan's Mick Foley, who was similarly distinct in a certain, call it niche style back in the day, then I really started to appreciate Ishii. I mentioned that to Rich, and I felt like for those who love WWE historically and might be looking around at other products to enjoy but are maybe on the fence about New Japan for whatever reason, that it might be worthwhile to have an exercise that makes several historical comparisons of current New Japan stars to WWE stars of the past. Rich took that a step further, drawing off the wild NBA offseason. He's going to suggest here in a little while, to me, a couple of trades, if you will. The trade will be of a current New Japan star for a historical comparison from WWE. And along the discussion that follows, whether or not I accept the trade, you will either learn about the New Japan star and make it easier for yourself to invest in something that Rich and I both feel is awesome, or maybe it'll perhaps instead enhance your NJPW fandom with the sort of fun exercise that this podcast, and Rich's too, FYI, frequently attempts to offer. I will be basing my acceptance of the trades on performance capability, the similarity of the wrestlers, the adaptability of the wrestler coming to WWE, and things of that nature. We'll be assuming reasonable competence on both parties, so we're not going to get into stuff like if they were booked properly. Let's not open that can of worms. So, do you think that sounds clear enough for our game to be played later, Rich?
Yeah, I think that's cool. I would also like throw out like talking, because there's an obvious language barrier on some of these choices. Besides that, we're kind of looking at like in-ring performance, as you mentioned, like slotability, like someone that can fill that person's role pretty much in both like cases. And then there's one guy that I feel like there is no WWE historical comp. So it's going to be pretty interesting. I've worked hard on, you know, going through my memory banks and seeing who was what and when, which is a passion that we both share, like as far as putting years on guys.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, before we get to that, folks, I mean, we're going to get to the trade machine here in a little while, but let's first give credit where it's due. Both of us are enjoying the hell out of the G1 climax right now, and you are through Saturday, July 20th's matches. I am through Saturday, July 19th, or Friday, July 19th's matches. So we're both pretty much almost caught up. You're caught up. I'm a little bit behind. But yeah. Overall impressions thus far of the G1?
I think it's been just a slow burning, like a slow burning monster that's about to like reach the top of the hill and just completely hit another gear. And I think it's already starting this weekend. I'm not all the way caught up. I've like seen every main event. Through night four, nights five and six, I need to watch some of the other undercard, but I can pretty much feel the temperature of what is going on. And I don't know if it's like last year where it was just like, hey, we're taking the top off everything from day one, but I think there's a little bit more of a slow build. And what they're doing in New Japan is what they are the best in the world at. Top end wrestling is in star creation and giving guys like a new look, like Lance Archer or Kenta or Jon Moxley, you know, all these guys. I actually was on Keeping It Strong Style last week with Jeremy and Josh brought up the point, like the way these has started, it has been kind of tough for a lot of the top guys, but it's a long-term elevation, essentially, of the guys that have gone off an early start. These guys, the top stars, will have someone to wrestle all throughout the next, like, 12 to 18 months, essentially. So I've enjoyed it thus far. I've liked the scheduling of it. A lot of times with the G1, you can get lost really quick with their primarily weekend shows. My strategy has been to wake up in the morning and watch the five matches, and then, you know, and one thing, if you watch enough New Japan, watching at night will make you fall asleep. Like there's no beating it, right? But if you watch it when you wake up, you don't have to fall asleep, and then you can just enjoy it and then move on with your day. But I've loved it so far.
For me, it's been fascinating to sit down and watch it, you know, in real time for the first time in my short, albeit, New Japan fandom. I mean, this is the first chance I've had, but G1, as I mentioned on the show last week, was basically what, by watching what last year's produced, it's general consensus that the 2018 G1 climax was the best ever.
I would probably say no, not the best ever, but the B block in it was like the 27 Yankees.
Gotcha.
Like,
okay,
because the A block had a lot of foolishness going on with Jay White doing his character to get over as a heel, Bad Luck Fale ruining the G1. There was a lot of things, but as far as like top end matches and then the exercise of putting everyone's star ratings down on paper, like it was insane between Ibushi, Ishii, and Omega. It was in Naito. It was nuts. And all those guys were in the same block. So you couldn't go wrong last year.
Watching all of those matches in the B block last year is really what I would say, more so than anything prior, is what built my New Japan fandom into what it is today. Someone who's willing to commit the time to keeping up with the G1 this year. It's been a wild experience. I mean, I've said before on this show that New Japan's the best example I've ever seen in its current form of pro wrestling as sport. And the way that the commentary, and it doesn't matter. It's kind of strange. It doesn't even matter if you watch the Japanese commentary and you don't speak Japanese. You totally get what they're going for.
Right.
You can just hear the passion like you would with sports. It doesn't sound phony. It sort of mirrors what's going on in your mind. So even though it's spoken in a different language, the inflection is actually something I enjoy listening to sometimes more than what I generally feel is still very good English commentary from New Japan World with Kevin Kelly and Rocky Romero. I mean, if you're talking about it as sport and you know what you're talking about, passion wins the day for me, even if you don't sound as, you know, as clear or as eloquent as someone like like an Excalibur does. I'm a really big fan of his, or Jim Ross historically in the NWA and at his peak in the WWF. But, you know, watching all this, and it just sort of piques my sports-related interest. I compared it online to being sort of like watching college football and that same sort of back-and-forth shootout element that you get a lot in college football nowadays. It feels that way, combined with performance art, which I think there's a lot of great storytelling going on in this G1 climax. And I thought one of the coolest things they've done, and I'll throw it back to you, I want to get your thoughts on this, is I think everybody kind of went into this tournament thinking that it was going to be Naito very obviously coming out of the B block. And I assume everyone probably feels that way as well. But I thought they did a great booking move by having him lose his first two, because, you know, he comes in as the heavy favorite, loses the first two, and now you kind of have to put him on the back burner while they're doing all this talk of the guys who have 6 points or whatnot. So I liked that dynamic. And then on the flip side, they did the same thing with Ibushi. And I thought, to me, even though Ibushi versus Naito 4 didn't seem like the final people wanted to see after seeing them virtually kill each other through the first half of 2019, that they put him so much on the back foot too was a really nice booking touch that sets the stage for what should be two comeback stories as the G1 advances.
Right, and in addition to that, Jay White, they made him start 0-3.
ZSJ's 0-3.
Yeah, Tanahashi was 0-2 to begin. And I think what they're trying to do in a lot of those cases, in Naito's case especially, as you mentioned, is kind of like humanize him and take away that element of where you think you know what's going to happen. And the great thing about New Japan is, like, it's so unpredictable. And the G1 is Gato's essentially victory lap of every year of, like, yeah, I have it's like I have the deepest chest of moves, I have the best strategy, I have the ability to tell whatever story I want, and it's going to end up working by Wrestle Kingdom. And it's like, you know, we used to see, like, the Royal Rumble, where the sub stories within the Royal Rumble, obviously the Royal Rumble was one big story itself. And I think one thing they do in New Japan is the G1 is a story in itself, and then it has little wrinkles. It's like Zack Sabre Jr.'s snapping because he can't figure out how to win anymore. Jay White has struggled with everyone in Chaos that he betrayed last year. Tanahashi's like fighting off another year, trying to win again, essentially. Ibushi is finally committed as a New Japan guy, and will that take him over the top? We've got Shingo and Will Ospreay as juniors in here. We've got a foreigner now that's like a huge star in Moxley. You got a guy that's been rising over in New Japan, like Juice Robinson, who's been coming through their ranks, doing it the right way, essentially coming from literally the bottom and then moving up rung by rung. So, and then the return of, like, Hiroki Goto, you know, a guy that we've affectionately, you know, named, like, the Dolph Ziggler of New Japan. But the thing about Goto was I've seen the best of Goto, and he's a phenomenal wrestler. Very hard-hitting and strong, and he's been disappointing, like, the last couple of years. And what they do is they use that. And they said this guy went away for months. He trained in L.A. with Shibata, who was his best friend since high school. He came back to the G1, essentially, I joked, like, he was training in the dark while Robert Tepper's No Easy Way Out was playing, and he was coming to beat Jay White up. Like, and it was almost like Holly Holm and Ronda Rousey. It's like, I might not beat anybody else, but I'll beat you. Like, and that's what it felt like for Goto. So there's a lot of, like, cool strains.
That was a great match, by the way.
Yes. There's, like, a lot of cool strains of storytelling in the G1 that just makes it the premier event in wrestling. It's the Champions League of wrestling.
That's a great way to put it right there. The Champions League of wrestling. I was sitting there trying to think earlier today is if there was something in sport that really compares to this. I guess it would have to be the Champions League would be the closest thing to it. But even still, I mean, it's these two big giant blocks of 10 wrestlers all wrestling each other. That to me is unlike anything we've seen. But I love the format, because even with something that's predetermined, you're sitting here watching that, just wondering what is going to unfold in the coming weeks because of the favorites, some falling back. There's a lot of storylines. Can Okada be the guy who is the first guy to hold the IWGP heavyweight title and win the G1 in, what is it, like close to 20 years?
Yeah, I think it's happened before. I'm not sure. I'd have to check, but like in modern times. Yeah, in modern times, like,
early 2000s.
Yeah, and what I look at the modern New Japan now is like 2012 and forward, essentially. And, you know, a lot of the New Japan fans now that I know are like newer. And, you know, they came to Dallas and they said, you know, the video that they played before the IWGP champion comes out. Like, no one started getting a pop until like 2012, and that's not an affront to like the rich history of New Japan. It's just a lot of people, we just didn't have access to it, you know. And what's happened now is these guys have really become like the first wave from Tanahashi forward. Like in 2012, they're the first wave of guys, essentially, like you know, you would say in like 1984, like that, you know, mix of like Hogan, Piper, Snuka, you know, different stuff like that. And those guys got to be the legends, essentially. Like, this is the class we're in right now with these guys.
Let's talk about some of the best matches of the G1 so far. Do you have like a little list that you've got put together that's got like top five?
I do have like a little list here, and I did watch the Ospreay and Okada as well, and I will leave that unspoiled for you.
But
I'll just talk about how good it was. Yeah, Ospreay and Okada, and then also Ospreay and Ibushi I watched, as well as Ishii and Mox. So some of the matches that I've really dug so far, I've liked Juice Robinson and Shingo Takagi a lot. I might be a little bit more high on it than some other folks, but I had that at 4.5. Like, it was just, they beat the hell out of each other. And if you guys haven't seen Shingo, he's like a junior that shouldn't be a junior that has been a legend in Dragon Gate, who's come over to New Japan, essentially, was not defeated for, I want to say, 10 months until the G1 finals, and then he essentially took his spot in the G1, and Juice Robinson fought, you know, really hard against him. I like Kenta and Tanahashi. You know, that's a match with just years behind it in Japan. You know, Kenta was in a rival promotion of New Japan, Noah, for years and years and years, so I took it as two guys in opposite neighborhoods that always heard about how bad the other one was, and then we finally found out, essentially.
Yeah.
Will Ospreay and Lance Archer is another one that I just loved. The epitome of a big man, small man match, where the big guy just reinvents his career all in one, you know, swoop or whatever. Ospreay and Sonata is another great one. Ospreay and Okada, just glorious. And then probably my favorite match thus far has been Tomohiro Ishii and Kota Ibushi and Will Ospreay. For me, has been the best match, and then after that was Ishii and Jon Moxley. And we did shows together talking about, yeah, you know, WWE is so stacked talent-wise, it would not be really a loss for them if they lost him. But what we did not say, Chad, was it would not be someone else's gain. We never said that.
Yeah, indeed.
So, and this guy has been a revelation in a way that I could not have predicted, because he's allowed to do all the brawling he wants to do. He's allowed to be this engaging character, and he has this partnership with Shota Umino where you just want to watch everything he does. And his match with Ishii was incredible. Did you see that one, Chad?
I did, man. I think that one of the things that stood out to me from watching Jon Moxley in that match, because personally, I mean, this summer has been full of great matches. If you extend the summer months, I guess unfairly, all the way back to the best of the Super Juniors final, or the super best of the Super Juniors tournament, the run that Ospreay has been on. There's been three John Moxley matches. I really loved the match he had with Joey Janela on AEW show.
Yep.
I really loved the match he had with Juice Robinson, and I love this match that he had with Ishii, and it just makes me think, man, don't you think that New Japan, I know that John Moxley, the commitment seems like it's with AEW, but don't you got to feel like New Japan's trying to figure out some way to get this guy to be on the Wrestle Kingdom cards over the next couple of years, like Jericho's been on them the last couple of years? Because John Moxley, to me, I mean, he's still the hottest act in the game. It's been 2 months since he showed up in AEW almost, and I still feel like this is the guy who is the most intriguing talent in the industry right now. The character work is there. The style is unique. I loved how tough he looked against Ishii. I mean, that was the draw for that match. That was the most anticipated match of the B block for me and for the whole tournament. I mean, that's, to me, that match was absolutely fantastic. But Ishii, to me, is the MVP of the tournament so far, because to me, he's 3 for 3, and he's the only person who's 3 for 3 to the extent that he is. Because that match with Moxley's right up at the top of the list. I do agree. It's below Ibushi and Ospreay. I will put over one match real quick and then hope to return to it a little bit later. One of my top five matches that no one's really talking much about is the night one Zack Sabre Jr. against Sonata. I thought was absolutely fantastic. I thought it was
smooth.
Absolutely fantastic. I love watching Zack Sabre Jr. wrestle. I mentioned this a lot last week, but Sonata is low key at the back part of my top five in New Japan Pro Wrestling. But you have those matches. But Ishii against Moxley, Ishii against Jay White was excellent. Ishii against Jeff Cobb was excellent. I thought all three of Ishii's matches were fantastic. So the last time you and I spoke, I was at a point in my New Japan fandom where I really wasn't that into Ishii. And here I sit nearly 6 months later, and you know, my opinion on him has completely changed. I really enjoy the passion that he brings and the stylistically distinct things that he does in the ring. And then he has the ability, and I think this is the key, is he's got the strong style. He's tough as nails. But when it comes time to fit in that very New Japan-specific excellent climax, that flurry toward the end where the sequencing has to be spot on to take it to that next level, he's capable of that, and because he and Moxley did that, him and Jay White, and him and Jeff Cobb, who's had a solid tournament in his own right, you know, just a big fan of what Ishii has done, and of course Moxley over the course of the past few months, just reinforcing what I always felt about him in WWE, which is that perhaps he was one of the most misunderstood stars of the last 5 years, one of the most misunderstood top stars, perhaps. Ever.
Yeah. First with Ishii, a couple months ago, I remember you telling me about, like, you just didn't see it with Ishii, and I was like, all right, I'm gonna let him figure it out, because there's no way that the Chad Matthews I know, if he watches enough Ishii matches, will be like, I don't get it. And I actually told Jeremy, James, and Josh, when you finally told me you came around on Ishii, everyone was like overjoyed, just with happiness. Like, yes. Like, Ishii is a guy that is flat out one of the greatest wrestlers who ever walked this planet. When you bring up the Foley thing, I think it's Foley in almost positioning only. He's a guy that he literally went his whole career just being just a regular journeyman, and then something clicked when he was 38 years old. Ishii's 43 right now. And if you look at this decade, if you write his matches down on paper, the amount of great matches that exist for Ishii, like, he is, as I mentioned, one of the great wrestlers who ever walked this planet. I'm so happy he's finally getting his due, and I decided to just start riding for him in a way that I only have, like, really rode for, like, Kenny Omega and, you know, guys like that, and Daniel Bryan, essentially. I was like, I'm just going to start cheering for Ishii. I'm going to try to speak it into existence. He's going to main event the Dome. He's going to win. And, you know, this guy, he's 5'6", but he wrestles like he's 6'6". And
he is a guy that, you know, he's too old, right? He has a horrible look. He has no, like, you know, real charismatic, you know, whatever. But when he starts fighting, he brings you in like no one other, like no one else, essentially. And I think he's just a legend of legends, essentially. And I was happy I got to, like, meet him and speak to him in New Orleans during WrestleMania 34 weekend. Just like, I don't, like, yo, you have so many fans in America. And the thing about Ishii is his style has translated to America, like, almost like an occult type. Like, the Ishii fans are deep in America. And go ahead.
Yeah, you go ahead. Finish up. What's up?
I was gonna say, now, as far as Moxley, he was misunderstood in WWE. They were clearly coaching him, like, he was receiving coaching that did not enhance him. That's what I feel like now.
Yeah, I think he was often miscast as, and this was the same, and by the fans who responded to what WWE was coaching him to do, he was misunderstood as mere brawler. Like, that was it. That's all he could do. And I think what we've seen from him in New Japan so far is a hybrid style that includes the brawling, which is an essential part of his game, but it's not the only part of his game. You know, he can get in there and he can do the slick sequencing. He can get in there and get real tough with you. He can get down on the ground and do some submissions and not look stupid doing it. I mean, this is a guy who's got a very multifaceted skill set. It just needed the opportunity to be unleashed. And I mean, usually WWE is a company that tries to pigeonhole you into being an either or. And Jon Moxley's the type of guy who wants to use the word and instead. I mean, he wants to add all of these different elements at the same time. So it's awesome. By the way, the Ishii comparison to Foley, you touched on one thing about Ishii that really brought Foley to mind, which was the look. You know, Mick Foley didn't look like a star either. He didn't look like the type of guy that was going to make it big. And then his style in the ring was so distinct to the top guy. So, you know, you watch New Japan and you're watching, like, my first exposure to New Japan in 20 years was Omega Okada at Wrestle Kingdom. So you watch that and you watch matches that follow a style like that, which I've come to associate with being New Japan's thing, is that they give people who can do that the biggest and best platform with the most stakes to go do it to maximally effective overall critical praise. Ishii doesn't offer you that. He's very distinct, kind of like Mick Foley was distinct to a Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart. So that's really more so where that comparison comes from me.
I can't wait until you see the Omega Ishii series. I don't know if you stumbled upon it yet, but
I saw the one from last year's G1.
And I want to say they've had 5 matches, if I'm not mistaken, and that was their 4th one in the G1, which may have been the best one. But there was 3 matches in 2017 and then 2 last year. It gotcha. Is like Ishii's he's on the level. Like
yeah.
So
I think do you have an MVP right now? I mean, I haven't thought enough about it to say to sway myself from my Ishii pick. He's just sitting up there at the top of my leaderboard, which right now, not having seen the Okada and Ospreay match, is Ibushi and Ospreay. I have Sonata and Zack Sabre Jr., Archer and Ospreay, Ishii and Moxley, Ishii and White. That's my top 5. Evil and Sonata is number 6. Ishii and Cobb, Okada, Tana, White and Goto, and then Jushin Shingo. That's my top 10. So Ishii has a lot at the top there. But is there somebody who you would favor as the MVP thus far ahead of him?
I think you're really only talking about Will. Will, and they're in the same class. You're talking about Will, you're talking about Ishii, and just behind them would be Okada, I would say.
I want to give a shout out here to Sonata again, because I think, you know, obviously my opinion of his match with Sabre Jr. seems to be above that. That's sort of, for me, what Juice and Shingo perhaps was for you.
Yeah.
No, I do agree. I mean, I think Juice, I have it written down in my notes here that I dig the Juice, and he's low-key one of those top five caliber guys for me, too. My top five in New Japan Pro Wrestling now is Ibushi, Osprey, Okada, Naito, and Sonata. But I had to give a real long thought to Robinson. So, but Sonata, I think, is awesome. I think he's got an ability to adapt to anybody's style. I think he's got speed. He's got power. He's got the submission holds. He's smooth as silk. He is just, to me, we've talked about this on Facebook. I mean, I asked you a while back. It's like, is Sonata one of those guys who we could just sort of see pop up out of nowhere to be in a big-time spot at a Wrestle Kingdom next year, as soon as next year? And I think that your answer was maybe a moderate yes.
Yeah, I think he could sneak his way, I wouldn't say, maybe into – they have a bad habit, really, and it maybe of – you know, he's not the number one guy in his unit, so that's going to be kind of hard for him to, like, kind of overtake Naito, right? So what they tend to do is, like, just put him back with Evil and do, like, a tag team thing, which is fine. They're an awesome tag team, but I think they have – they have their stars in their own right, both guys.
And have you seen their match?
I have not seen it yet. No,
it's great. It's got an extra intangible layer to it that most of these other matches don't have because of their tag team dynamic.
I might have to check that out. But Sonata, I think he sneaks his way in. Since they're doing two domes, he could easily be in the, you know, top three matches at, you know, if you're talking about the main event, semi-main, and then the third match underneath. I think he could be in a third match underneath.
All right, well, before we move on from the G1 here and move into our trade machine game, is there some sort of surprise that you could see being set up through the first? I mean, we're now, B-Block finishes its fourth matches tomorrow, so, or as of when you hear this, today. So, anything that you could foresee being like someone makes the final that maybe people weren't expecting in the beginning, or someone wins it that isn't?
So there,
Naito?
There are two things that I'm kind of seeing that are out there. One of them from like a journalist, the other one that is just like, it could happen, right? Just based on how everything's setting up. Like now, Fumi Saito, who is essentially the Meltzer of Japan, he is a reporter that has been reporting on everything in New Japan forever. He thinks John Moxley is going to main event Wrestle Kingdom.
Really?
Yes. And if you look at it, right, the level of star he is, how hot he is right now, the use that they have for him, how much they're putting him over, they have a title on him already, and they actually mean something in this company. He thinks that John Moxley could be looking at the Wrestle Kingdom main event. And if you look at it, he's in the opposite block of the champion. He's off to a fast start. He's got a match against Juice Robinson on the last day. There are a lot of things in play, you know, that are going to have to go for the presumed favorites to catch up to him. Now, on the other side, something that I've just been talking about with a bunch of my friends, Kenta could win the A block. It's nothing to win a block and then lose the G1 final. That can happen to anybody. Like, Goto won a block in 2016. If he's able to defeat Okada and essentially set up a title match that may, you know, happen in the second half of the year, essentially would you know, get him with a tiebreaker. And everyone else kind of just flounders. Kenta's jumped off to a fast start where he could end up – you know, in an A block and then putting someone over like Naito in the final, essentially. So a couple of things out there I think you want to watch out for.
One thought that's continually gone through my mind as the tournament started and has continued to be dominant because of the way that he started since that point is Okada winning. Okada winning and creating a new dynamic for this era. It's not been done before. It's you know, I don't even know what happens if he does win. Like, what does that mean? Does he get to pick his opponent?
Yes, he gets to pick his opponent.
Getting to pick his opponent, I think, would be a very interesting thing to see. I don't know who he would pick. I'm still holding out hope personally. I want to see Kota Ibushi versus Okada in the Wrestle Kingdom main event. That's my pick. That's my choice. That probably doesn't seem like it's super likely, but it's not also super unlikely. But Okada winning, to me, is one of those dynamics that I feel like it's an untapped thing to explore, and it's an obvious one for them to explore here in the modern era. So there's that. And then I was going to echo the John Moxley winning the B block. I thought when he started this journey that it was Naito and everybody else, and it was by some distance, and it seemed like, I don't know, maybe Jay White would have a big tournament, and that maybe he, and I don't know when him and when do him and Naito meet?
I think they're the final match of B block.
So, you know, I thought maybe that would play into it, but at this point, unless it's Ishii coming out of nowhere to win it with all the popularity you mentioned and him being just sort of a step away, a break the glass here, let's do this.
Right. Because they could do it. They could do it, and no one would complain.
But Moxley's an interesting one. Well, let's maybe come back to that if we have any time, but let's get to our game and let's open up the trade machine. Let's get this thing going. In WWE, that would be me, I guess. I'm representing WWE. Rich is New Japan. Let's turn this sucker on, Rich. What do you got for me?
Da-da-da-da-da-da. All righty. So I have six guys written down, and of course a seventh who has no historical comp, who is almost like, make me an offer. Like, so I'm going to start with Tetsuya Naito. So when I'm thinking about Tetsuya Naito, I'm thinking about a guy that is a top star, has a fanatical fan base, maybe not the company poster boy, maybe not, but he's the man of the people, the ones that the people have chosen. And for me, two guys came to mind. 2012 to 2013, CM Punk. Or 1992, Randy Savage, if he was on a babyface trajectory, essentially.
Oh, man. The 1992 Macho Man. Given where Naito is at in his career and where Savage was obviously going to go on to have a very respectable run in WCW, but by that point had already peaked. Naito, folks, if you're not that familiar with him, Naito has a lot of charisma, and that's one of my favorite things about him. I think that, and it's actually funny, if you go back and you watch him from like 2012 to 2019, the difference in the way he just looks on his face is so different. It's one of the more distinct facial expression changes that you will see. So obviously there is going to be the language barrier like Rich mentioned, but if I'm just looking at characteristics of someone who's got a lot of charisma that would have a magnetism, Naito has that same kind of magnetism that Savage has. Obviously, perhaps not to that extent. I think if he did, perhaps he would be unquestionably one of those guys in New Japan who's already been in the position to challenge as the ace like Okada has of Tana. I don't know, man. I mean, bounce some ideas back and forth with me here. You sell me a little bit on Randy Savage, because the one that makes more sense to me, I think, is CM Punk.
Yeah, so for Randy Savage, like, for me, it breaks down to the concept of the dark ace, which I've had conversations about Josh with, who every era there's an ace. There's an A side. There's a face of a company. But then there's the other guy who's the other side. And I can't think of someone that's embodied being the dark ace more than Randy Savage. And with Tetsuya Naito essentially in the shadow of Okada, and before that, like, you know, think he was going to be the next Tanahashi, but he wasn't. He ended up getting the Nakamura role. I think from a wrestling perspective, they could both slot into each other's role quite easily. With Savage possibly having somewhat of a lower ceiling now just because of, you know, we can't predict if Randy Savage wants to land on his head, right? I doubt that. But
and he's on the decline in 1992. I mean, the work he did in WCW was memorable, but it was never quite on that level of the type of critical heights he was able to reach in WWE.
And the only thing I say about Naito is he could be on the decline too, but physically. Like, he's put his body – he has high mileage, let's say that. And I believe they are at a similar age, like age-wise, around this time. I believe Naito's 36, if I'm not mistaken. Savage in 1992 would have been – I'm not sure how old he would have been, but I believe he might have been 40 in, like, 93, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so, I think he would have been a fair few many years older than Naito.
Yeah, so I lob Randy up like as a suggestion. Maybe you could even break out an earlier version of Savage. You can take it back to 1991 at WrestleMania 7 as Tetsuya Naito.
Okay, well, here's the deal. If we're going to say 1992 is the year, I'll take that trade and I'll bring Naito over for the following reason. Naito, at this point in time, he may be on the decline, but the body of work is still there.
Right.
The matches this year with Ibushi. If I'm going into 1992, 1993 WWF, when you have guys like Bret Hart on the rise and into the main event, Shawn Michaels soon to follow in the years that in just within 18 months of Bret, really. You know, if you've got that caliber of worker rising to the forefront, and that's the kind of main events you're going to start seeing is guys who were in that class athletically and intelligently in the ring. Randy Savage was great. I don't know that Randy Savage would have meshed incredibly well with Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart types in that main event role come 1992-93. Mm-hmm. Randy Savage was on more of a physical decline at that point in his career than Naito now. But Naito would bring an interesting sort of charisma to the table. So I would say I would take the Naito trade. I would not accept the CM Punk trade, however, because if you're talking about CM Punk in 2012, 2013, even I said this in my book, my first book regarding Terry Funk. I was like, I'll take 6 months of 1989 Terry Funk over 6 years of someone less transcendent. And mm-hmm. 2012, 2013, CM Punk was transcendent. That's one of my favorite runs for any wrestler ever. The combination of his in-ring quality and his ability to get on a microphone and speak to me in a way that connected and made him my fan anchor, be a tough thing for me to trade CM mm-hmm. Punk for Naito in that regard.
Gotcha.
Too much value for CM Punk at that point to, you know, you talk about there really wouldn't be many people on the planet historically at any point from any promotion that I would trade for, that I would trade CM Punk for.
High value. Awesome, man. So my next guy that I have on the list is Kota Ibushi. Of course, one of your favorite guys in New Japan. And my idea behind Kota Ibushi, if I was trying to give him up, what I needed in return were like just absolutely physical freaks that were just the best wrestlers you could think of for the time period that could easily step in and we could swap Ibushi with, who Ibushi could essentially replicate their performance because, like Sonata, he's a chameleon, essentially. So I came up with three guys who I felt, I think, you know, would be of equal value. So I've got 2005 Kurt Angle for Kota Ibushi. I've got 1987 Ricky Steamboat, and I've got 2016 AJ Styles.
Whew. Man. Oh, man. All three of those are really interesting choices. Okay, all right. Well, here's the thing. Let's start with Ricky Steamboat. I mean, if you're looking for somebody, if you're a fan that has been really studying the WrestleMania era, and you're looking for somebody that some of these top Japanese stars, particularly Ibushi, and to me Tanahashi, the guy they best compare to historically, in my opinion, is Ricky Steamboat. The Dragon's abilities in between the ropes, his ability to sell. Sort of that over-the-top, old-school way that he sells, that's something that Ibushi does incredibly well. And he's more athletic than just about anybody in the game today. So, ooh, man, that one would be very difficult because you'd be expecting Ibushi to step onto the WrestleMania 3 stage with Randy Savage. and produce the same caliber of match. And I don't mean, I don't know that I think that he couldn't. And that I know, I mean, for anybody listening to that who's really old school and doesn't know much about Kota Ibushi, let this be my highest form of praise. He might be the best wrestler in the world.
Yes, he may be the most singly talented wrestler ever.
Like, there's nothing that he can't do. Yeah, I think I would take that trade for sure. I would absolutely swap those guys. 2005 Kurt Angle.
And I say that, like, both with the neck problems. Both,
yeah.
Well, both still,
time
like...
bombs.
Yeah, both these guys are high mileage. Both these guys are still physical anomalies. Like, Ibushi's 37 right now. He doesn't, from what I've learned about him, he doesn't have a regular workout regimen. He just looks like that. Like, which is insane. Kurt Angle, we all know what type of machine he was, you know, athletically and physically. But yeah, and then thinking about WrestleMania 21, could I have put, you know, Kota Ibushi in there with Shawn Michaels? I think you can.
I think you can too. Yeah. I think you can too. You're right around there, you're getting that match with Undertaker shortly thereafter. Angle practically going out every time that he had a huge match like that, putting everything he had out there to remind you that he was still capable of doing that if only his body would cooperate. He couldn't make his body do that all the time like he could in 2002, but he was willing to put it on the line like that in 2005 against guys like Michaels and Taker. Both Ibushi and Angle at that point, if you look at them, where Ibushi's at now and Angle was at then, they remind me of that scene in, if you've ever seen the movie Friday Night Lights, where Derek Luke's Booby Miles character is just kind of joking around with everybody in the locker room with all of his recruitment letters, and the quarterback says, "Booby, you didn't lift." He said, "I don't need to. This is God-given. All I got to do is show up." And then the next game, and then the next scene is him, you know, tearing it up in the game in which he blows out his knee and basically upends a once promising career. You have that same ticking time bomb feeling about Kurt Angle in 05 and Ibushi now, where it's like we could be 6 months away from seeing this person fade into obscurity because their body just couldn't hold up anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not taking that trade because that era Kurt Angle for me, talk about high value in the CM Punk role. I know there's a possibility I would take it because I think Ibushi has got potentially more years left, but Kurt Angle leaves, goes to TNA, and has some pretty damn good years in his own right. So I'm going to go, knowing what I know historically, I'm going to hang on to Kurt Angle there. As for 2016 AJ Styles, you and I had many conversations. That was really the year when you and I started getting on this podcast and having our conversations. That's when you became a regular on the show, and it was regularly during that year where we would sit down and talk about the kind of run that AJ Styles went on from the matches with Roman Reigns through the WrestleMania match the following year with Shane McMahon. And we would always say, wow, isn't it amazing that somebody can have that number of four-star matches in a year's time? They could average four-star matches in a year's time. And then you go over and you start watching more New Japan, and it's like these guys are not only having great matches, four-star matches, but they're having all-time great matches in 6 months, the number that many would have an entire career as of a few years ago.
Right.
So, absolutely, I take that trade because I'm getting Kota Ibushi at a level that's even higher than AJ Styles as of 2016. I would absolutely take Kota Ibushi over AJ Styles, respectfully to Styles, who is amazing. But it'd be like if you offered me 2005 AJ Styles for 2016 AJ Styles, I'd take that trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. So my next guy on the list, Hiroshi Tanahashi. Now, Hiroshi Tanahashi, where I'm looking at him in his career, is he's an older version of himself. He is a guy that can still do it when called upon, but he might not be at his physical peak anymore. But he's still, like, what the body can no longer do, the mind has essentially adapted to. So this, and you know, looking at him, he's always been the, I think if you put these three guys in a blender, you get what Tanahashi is today, essentially. So I will go with 1996, Looking for Respect, Bret Hart. I will go with
1996, Looking for Respect, Bret Hart. Well, I think at this point, I've made several moves already with the wrestlers you've thus far suggested. I think it would be very challenging for me to sit here and continue my run of accepting these trades, moving the guys from Japan to WWE at these peak historical points. So I'm going to be a little stricter this time, and though I very much respect Hiroshi Tanahashi, he does own what I feel is New Japan and the world's best match of 2019 thus far with Kenny Omega at Wrestle Kingdom. I'm going to say no to that one. I'm going to hang on to 1996 Bret Hart because I don't want to move 1996 Bret Hart out of the way of what's to come in 1997. Despite that being perhaps the worst year of his professional life in one way, it was the best year of his professional life in others, and I don't want to lose that Bret Hart.
So I've got 2008 Shawn Michaels.
Oh.
And then
I've
got
another big-time value pick for me. That's my all-time favorite wrestler against the guy who my all-time favorite wrestler who's been compared to most in the New Japan circuit. I'm going to say no to that because I think 2008 Shawn Michaels is one of the best versions of Shawn Michaels we ever got.
And then I've got 2015 John Cena.
I'll take that trade because I think that right now when I look back at 2015 John Cena, I enjoyed it a lot more in the moment than I have looking back on it. And with Hiroshi Tanahashi, I don't think there's much doubt that I'll go back and I'll watch something like the match he had with Omega and look very fondly on it for a very long time. I don't see there being much drop in quality on replay. So I will take that trade with respect to John Cena, who I have defended on this podcast for years. So don't get me wrong. I think very highly of that version of John Cena. I think he needed it for his career, but I'll take the trade and take on Tana during that time.
That works. Higher that works. Ceiling. Yep. Okay. Now the guy that is the presumed wrestler of the year, I would assume he has locked this up and thrown away the key based on what I've watched this morning. Will Ospreay. So for me, I'm looking strictly at a talent perspective here, and could I have dropped the 26-year-old Will Ospreay into whatever era and asked him to do this, right? And I only came up with two guys in WWE history who I thought were, you know, someone that I would like, all right, go do what that guy did and, or do it better. Now, I've got 1996 Shawn Michaels. And I've got 1994 Owen Hart.
Oh, man. For my personal fandom, it doesn't get much more nostalgic for me than 1996 Shawn Michaels. Basically, 1996 Shawn Michaels taught me to appreciate the very style of professional wrestling that I most favor today. 1994 Owen Hart is also an interesting one because I'm not sure anybody could ever do 1994 Owen Hart like 1994 Owen Hart. So let me think about that for a second and let me throw it back at you. Is there anybody that you've brought up thus far, any of these comps where you are absolutely accepting or absolutely not accepting these trades yourself?
So, if it was me, I want to say I would not have accepted the Randy Savage Naito one. I would accept the CM Punk Naito one. I would accept the Angle one. I would not accept the Steamboat one. I would accept the Styles. I would accept the Bret Hart. I would accept the Shawn Michaels and I would accept the John Cena. I would, and we're here now.
Oh, man. I don't think. I'm gonna stick with my original thought on Owen Hart. I don't think anybody could have done that like him. I mean, it's a brother versus brother dynamic. You can't. Nobody could have done that but Owen. I mean, if we take that element out, then I guess, but I can't take that element out. Can you? I mean, can you take out the element that it's that Owen being Brett's brother was part of the big part that allowed that whole thing to work so well?
I don't know if Will Ospreay could have been like the pricky asshole that he could have been, but it would have been like wrestling wise, I think there I could see Owen, like, if we're like, all right, Owen, the chains are off, go be the best wrestler in the world. I think 1994 Owen Hart could do that.
On that side, yeah, I mean, I'm sure you would accept the trade. I mean, with respect to Ospreay, I mean, I'm talking about 1994 Owen Hart. I mean, I've used the term low key numerous times. I mean, that's low key one of the top. I mean, that's one of the best acts of the WrestleMania era. I do think Ospreay could come in and do the kind of stuff Shawn Michaels was doing, because it doesn't take. I mean, he probably comes in and does it a little better, frankly, when it comes to character, because Shawn Michaels was not a natural heroic figure.
And I'll push back on that. Neither is Will Ospreay. But he's been trying his ass off to become like this beloved babyface. And I think it's working in Japan. Now,
It's working for
worldwide,
me.
yeah, now worldwide, I don't know, just because Will Ospreay, he's got a lot of that asshole prickishness that Shawn Michaels has. This is a lot closer comparison than you think.
Yeah, I guess you put it that way, putting it into further context and letting me know that. I mean, I'm thinking now about the Twitter exchange with Seth Rollins, as an example of maybe a better reflection of who he is than what we see on on TV from his character.
Well, and that was one of his bright spots. Like
Yes.
his low points are like among the lowest of the low of wrestlers
Bullshit.
on
When you
Twitter.
bring it up
So,
that way, I mean
yeah.
that basically makes them practically the same guy, but Ospreay's was is just a little bit. I don't know, man. Shawn Michaels was in terms of selling. I like the way that Ospreay sells, but Shawn Michaels sells better than just about anybody I've ever seen, or at least for my tastes. That Shawn Michaels' style of selling is not over the top, and I think sometimes what you'll see can be over the top from other guys. So, yeah, that's close. I don't think I'm gonna say no, actually. Upon further thought, I think
So if you look at
Ospreay
the matches,
athletically.
yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say Ospreay athletically. That's what makes me lean towards saying yes, because you would have just taken what Shawn Michaels was doing to an evolutionary athletic level, but switching it around, Shawn Michaels. That's also asking me to remove a big part of my nostalgic resonance for Shawn Michaels, and that's tough to do. That's to me, that's like, asking me to trade James Harden in his prime if I'm the Houston Rockets. It's like, okay, I'd maybe consider that, but I lose the identity of who my team is and what makes it special if I get rid of this guy.
So I'm thinking about all the matches that HBK had in 96. I'm thinking about Diesel, which is essentially the Lance Archer match from last week. I'm thinking about him wrestling against Foley. I'm thinking about him wrestling against Sid, Vader, and Ospreay just slotting easily into all those roles. Could you imagine Will Ospreay getting powerbombed by Psycho Sid through a table, or excuse me, powerbombed by Diesel through the table? I think they're the same guy.
So you would take that?
I would take it in a heartbeat.
Gotcha. Yeah, I can see that. I'm not, throw in a
Look.
hypothetical draft pick and we got it.
Right. That's what I was
Trade
thinking too.
complete. Give me
Look,
a second rounder in cash.
and Ospreay's 5 years younger than Shawn was in 1996. So, man. All right.
Yeah.
The next one should be probably the most interesting one of them all, because I came up with four
different guys here. And this is Jay White. So for Jay White, I've got four guys deep on the psychological kind of slower paced, but also can turn it up in the right situations that can be just a prick asshole that people don't want to cheer, or there's some psychopath. One of the two things. Or they're also in a spot that people say they might not be ready for. So there's a bunch of that.
Orton in here.
So he fits one of the parts, not that one. So I've got Randy Orton in 2007. Okay. So I believe that would have made him 26 years old at that point, which is Jay White's age. I've got Edge in 2005 when he first breaks through. I've got 1999 Triple H when he first shows up, and he's been, you know, he all of a sudden, this guy's a muscle factory after just being a skinny geek. Then I've got 1991 Jake Roberts.
Oh, man. Okay, so no Jake Roberts. Not trading Jake Roberts for Jay White. I'm not trading 07 Randy Orton for Jay White. I am trading 99 Triple H for Jay White. That, on our first podcast in this era of the show, that was the comparison that we talked about, and I agree with that one. I don't know if you remember that, but that was, that's one we talked about, and I think Jay White has proven to me, I like the opportunity to talk about Jay White, in fact, because we barely talked about him when our G1 discussion was going on, but I think Jay White has had a great year, and I've really grown fond of Jay White's game, particularly when he gets some time. You give that guy 15 minutes and what he produces is fairly, I mean, it's good, but it's nothing special. You give him 20 plus to tell his story, to be that prickish heel, to talk his trash. He's very good settling into those climactic moments too. He's got that aspect of the New Japan routine down really right. Well, and he's only getting better.
And so, he's got the ability to, like, I think this is the best match I've seen in person this year, which was the main event at Madison Square Garden. I was there. The entire garden was on their feet. We were living and dying with Okada, and a lot of that had to do with Jay White.
That was an excellent match, I thought.
Yeah.
That's the only reason why I would say that maybe I would take the trade with Jake Roberts is because Jay White is, I think, athletically at a point where, you know, I like seeing great wrestling matches. Jake Roberts very rarely showed me something that I remember because of his athletic performance. It's more because of his psychology and his character. But in terms of psychology and character, it's just a landslide victory the other way, at least for the time being. Jay White, I think, has a lot of upside. He's proven that this year. How old is he? Like 26?
26.
26. He's 26 years old. I still wouldn't do it. Just because I don't think Jay White, with what suits him best in 1991, doesn't suit, is not a good fit with WWF at the time. Let's see, 07 Orton I think has just got that's Orton getting into his prime and his peak, and wrestling wise, Jay White is an upgrade, but that's the era of Orton that made me such a fan of his. I'd have to maybe be given another year and a half to 2 years of Jay White progressing before taking that trade. 99 Triple H I've already accepted because of the in-ring upside. Who was the other one?
Edge in 2005.
No to that one as well. I am not trading Jay White.
I offended this man. Yeah.
No, sir. You know, and, you know, for those who don't know, Edge is my second favorite wrestler of all time. 2005 built that extra layer of emotional resonance to where when he cashed in 06, it was one of my favorite moments as a wrestling fan. So sorry, Jay White, brother, you're not there. I need you to, that's going to have to be, you're going to have to give me Jay White and some first rounders. I'm going to be asking I'm going to be asking a Russell Westbrook like ransom for a 2005
Paul
edge.
George. Yeah, well, I need five first round. I need five call ups from NXT to put in the time machine to go with him. Right.
I'm going to need the Undisputed Era, and I'm going to need.
That's
Wait,
great.
You'll do it? Okay, sure, absolutely. Yeah, by all means, let's make that trade.
That's great. Awesome, man. And I've got one more before the wild card one.
Okay.
It's Tomohiro Ishii, the guy that we talked before. And I could only think of two guys that and they're diametrically opposite kind of guys. One has an excellent body, one has a horrible body. One has a great love for the business. The other one couldn't give a fuck about the business. The one of them that was crowned essentially the second he came in. The other one had to scratch and claw. I think you know where I'm going with this. So
I think I do too. Yeah.
So I've got 1996 Mick Foley and 2002 Brock Lesnar.
Oh man. Well, the Brock Lesnar one. Is actually kind of hard, and the only reason it's hard is because I loved that Brock Lesnar back then. I mean, I think that Brock Lesnar at the time, if I'm going back and I'm in the 2002 headspace, then there's not a prospect on earth that, you know, I mean, who would you? I mean, is there a long list? I mean, I know neither one of us can hardly stand what Brock Lesnar represents today, but back then, he represented all the potential in the world to be the next great star in professional wrestling. So I would be curious throwing that back at you. Like, that, are there many guys who you would, if you're in 2002 WWE mode, that you would trade for Brock Lesnar?
I think you have to be talking about, like, The Rock.
And even then, I mean, if you're talking about, you know, rookie year for rookie year, like for like. I mean, is there any way that Dwayne Johnson, that Rocky Maivia, is someone you would trade for 2002 Brock Lesnar? I mean, if the exercise is you know what The Rock goes on to do, then obviously yeah. But I mean, my God, I mean, the Brock Lesnar of that era, I think it'd be real damn hard to make that trade. I can't make either one of those trades because I think, you know, 1996 Mick Foley is just I love Tomohiro Ishii. I saw somebody on Twitter the other day say that there's never been anyone like him. There's never been a scenario like him. I'm going to support that, and I'm going to say that as much praise as he deserves, this is the exact right time and exact right place for him to exist in the space that he does.
Mm-hmm. Awesome, man. And, of course, my wild card guy is Okada. And the only person I can think of, ironically, we just mentioned him. It would be a version of The Rock.
Let me ask you this. I mean, now, for those listening, maybe you're new since this show has joined the Chairshot Network and you've never heard Rich and I speak before. Rich will readily tell you his thing in wrestling, what gets him in the building and what keeps him watching is great wrestling matches. Right?
Yeah, great wrestling matches and then someone, you know, it's great matches and then great talking.
Great matches and great talking. So I honestly, I'd be more curious to know if you'd take this trade. Like peak Rock, let's say, you know, were, you know, early 2000s Rock, you know, something like that. You
like
know,
2001 or, Rock.
Yeah,
like
2000.
Going into WrestleMania 17.
If you know he's leaving, you take it. But you if you don't know he's leaving.
Yeah.
How can you? I mean, because at that point, Rock is at his athletic best. Rock has proven he can work his style almost against any opponent and make it work. I mean, he can toughen it up when he needs to toughen it up. He can speed it up when he needs to speed it up. He can brawl. He can. I mean, he was. I've always felt that The Rock was a really underrated worker. Different, sure, but his own style tended to mesh with a lot of other styles. Kazuchika Okada, those for those who don't know, Kazuchika Okada's, you know, pretty much, I mean, there's not a, you don't get very far in who's the best wrestler in the world conversation without his name coming up prominently. I mean, this is one of the greatest wrestlers ever at the ripe old age of
32. Like,
of 32.
I think he's 32. So I actually
body
sent,
work is insane.
I actually sent Dave Fenichel a cage match listing of pro wrestling performers, right? And basically what they're rated out of 10, and it's basically by hundreds of users. I sent him the, and I'm going to send these to you as well. And I think you'll find this very interesting to see, like, you know, who's where. And number five on that list is Kazuchika Okada. So that's the kind of guy we're talking about right now. Number six would be Shawn Michaels, and seven is Tanahashi. Number one, of course, the late Masaru Misawa, Jumbo Tsuruta, Mako Satomura, and Kenta Kobashi are the people that are in front of Okada. So, and this list includes people like Paul Heyman as non-wrestling performers, Austin, Cesaro, like different things like that. So I would be interested if you looked at that, but I really struggle to come up with a historical WWE guy for Okada aside from a version of The Rock.
That's a great comparison. I don't know, man. That's tough. That's really, really tough. I'm gonna have to. That's one of those types. I'll be, you know, I'm gonna need the Hamptons Five to come to my house on the beach and really, you know, really sell me on that. I mean, because you could do it. You could definitely sell me on that. I am a big enough fan of Okada's in-ring work. It's just that body of work and what he's been able to accomplish, and how, I mean, he works a hard hitting style. The New Japan style just is, but I mean, he's not the kind of worker who you think won't be around in 5 years. Right. I mean, I get the sense that, you know, this is a guy who's going to be around for decade too. Yeah.
He can last forever because, like, the only thing he'll do that will be taxing on him will eventually be the drop kick and maybe the elbow off the top rope. Aside from that, I watched a match of his against AJ Styles from 2014, no, 2015, if I'm not mistaken. And he was doing the topes over the top rope. Like, he's cut that stuff out already. So he's going to be even better when he gets older, essentially. He's going to be like how, like, he's the, like, the game's going to slow down for him a little bit. He's not going to have to do as much, but he's going to have his mental, like, his body's going to go down, his mind's only going to go up, and his mind's already been up.
Oh, man. Yeah. You could definitely convince me. It's going to be, I'm going to leave it up in the air and take that question to Twitter. Let's put that out to the public. I mean, that's let's leak that information to the public and see what the public sentiment is. If everyone comes back and says, no, that's crazy, then I won't even consider it. But if everyone says, oh yeah, absolutely, then I'll more strongly consider it. But that's an interesting one. Okada is unique. There's no question about that. He is very unique. So, well, cool, man. That's
my list.
That's the list. I dug that. That was fun. That's awesome. That's all on the fly, ladies and gentlemen. I purposefully asked not to know who the comps were going to be ahead of time. He let me know who the New Japan stars would be, but not who the comps were going to be. So that's all me hearing those for the first time. So, well, cool, man. It's as always, it's always a blast to talk to you. It's a great time in pro wrestling. I feel like there were probably four or five other topics we could have easily gotten to. So, you know, let's try not to make it 4.5-5 months again before you come back.
Yeah, man, we'll have to have you on O&R going into All Out.
Hell yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure,
loving,
man.
Loving talking about AEW lately. Well, plug your stuff, man. Tell people where they can find you on Twitter. Tell them about the podcast, etc.
For sure, man. You guys can follow me on Twitter at RichLatta32. I host One Nation Radio over on the Social Suplex Podcast Network. I have not written in a long time, but I have a feeling that's going to eventually start happening again. But yeah, just come through and hit me with a follow. Let me know you heard the show. And
cool.
check out everyone else over on Social Suplex Podcast Network as well.
While you're at it, check out the rest of the Chair Shot Radio Network's lineup. Take a look at my old pals from LOP Radio as well on lordsofpain.net. There's so much good wrestling content out there these days. Mix and match it, folks. There's a lot of interesting opinions out there that you can get engaged with on social media. That's the fun part of this. It doesn't always have to be so doom and gloom talking about what WWE screwed up this week. So there's a lot of really cool stuff out there. We didn't get to it, but you know, Impact Wrestling, I want to dedicate some time to that next week because I think they deserve it. I think they're doing a really good job right now. And if you're not paying attention or if you long since wrote them off, then if you've got a few hours of free time in the coming weeks, then that's worth your time also. So I appreciate you coming on the show, Rich. As always, it's a pleasure having you.
Thanks
Ladies
for having
and gentlemen,
me, man.
Absolutely, brother. Check out at the Doc LOP on Twitter to discuss New Japan, the G1 Climax, WWE SummerSlam, and NXT's TakeOvers coming up, Impact Wrestling, and all the other cool stuff that's going on with AEW. So for Rich Latta, this has been the Doc Chad Matthews. Everybody have a great, great week. And your next appointment here, what the Doc says, is next Sunday, July the 28th. We'll catch you then.
This is just what the Doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the Mania Era is bringing terror on radio. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast. Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania